Today is December 13th, 2018. This is episode 492 of the Apple Context Machine. It's a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Brian Chaffin, editor-in-chief of TMO. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. If you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, you can join us at facebook.com/groups/context machine. Now today my guest is Mr. Martellaro, Mr. John Martellaro, one of my favorite writers and analysts in the Apple space, and as big a gentleman as ever graced that big blue marble we call Earth. He hosts Background Mode, a weekly interview with bright minds, creative wonks, scientists, writers, and once even me. He has also been writing for TMO for 12 years now, or as I like to call it, one design cycle of the Mac Pro. Seemingly.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, John. Welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm excited to be here. This is going to be fun. We've never done this before, and I'm eager to start talking to you.
Yeah, we did a one-on-one, of course, on your show, but that's more of an interview format. We've never gone one-on-one where we're just sort of banging on some topics and exploring them.
Yeah, so let's do number one. Hope there's many more.
You'll be back. Yeah, you're like a recurring guest number five.
Like in a recurring infestation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sure, is there a treatment for that?
Yep, by the way, I also have to add that one of the reasons why I love John is because he has no idea what the Mr. Martellaro, Mr. John Martellaro reference even is. He has no idea. Like, it's not even a thing to him. And I love that. I love that. So, all right. On that pop culture note, John.
Yes.
You wanted to talk about Apple in the medical industry. Am I getting this right?
Yes, and especially health monitoring.
Health monitoring. Right? Yeah, what's on your mind?
We tend to think of Apple as being a leader. We tend to think of Apple's being an innovator, and we're always thinking about the cool things we can do with our Apple Watch in terms of keeping alerts on our pulse and tracking our pulse and tracking our steps and exercise and the calories and we use in the standing hours, and now the ECG, electrocardiogram, it came with watchOS 5.1.2.
Yep.
On the Series 4s.
I'm doing it now.
And I hope I'm not getting you too excited. But there's a lot more that's coming, and Apple's just getting started. And while it's relatively easy technologically to roll out some of these features in the Apple Watch, now it's going to start getting really hard because the next phase is organizing our health records, organizing clinical trials, doing remote medicine.
The next phase that we know about.
Yeah. And as this gets rolling, there's going to be so many players and there's going to be so many people who want a piece of the action that the early sort of cool technical lead that Apple has with its Apple Watch is going to have to be sustained, which means that Apple's going to have to work really hard to be both a player and a competitor and a cooperating partner in a lot of this stuff, because it's a very large field and it's very complex.
Yeah, okay, fine. Right? This is true. I'm assuming they have a game plan and that they will, in fact, be able to stay ahead of competitors. That actually doesn't concern me all that much. Here's what I think is a better question, John. A better angle on this, or at least for discussion. You know how Tim has told us that he wants a piece of the medical industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he calls it like a $1 trillion industry. And the point of him saying that is, hey, Wall Street, we're working on this. If you don't think that we have room to grow, you're wrong. That's his point. But my question is, how does Apple actually do that? How do they take, you know, is he hinging all of that just on, you know, Apple Watch and then the ability to sync data securely through iOS? You know, like how does Apple become a player in the medical industry enough for it to be a, you know, more than a blip on their radar?
Well, let me give you an example of that comes to mind, and that is a couple of things I ran across in the construction of this article. There are things you can do non-invasively with the Apple Watch, optically and electrically, but some of this medical monitoring requires invasive techniques, embedding of an electrode or something that's wired into your hand or something that's inserted into your heart or into your bloodstream. And that requires FDA approval. That requires a medical technician in a doctor's office to insert it and monitor it. So Apple has to decide how deeply it wants to penetrate the industry, so to speak, in terms of the establishment of medical instrumentation.
But to that point, Tim has also talked about the fact that Apple is uniquely positioned to make money by dealing with end users instead of insurance companies. He's talked at length about how, like, the entire medical industry, at least in the United States, is geared around selling crap to insurance companies. So, right? So the customer is the insurance company, and then the end user ends up being the patient who is using, you know, whatever it is that the insurance company has decided to pony up for. And he says that Apple is uniquely positioned to not have to give a crap about the insurance companies, that Apple can sell devices and products and services directly to consumers. So how does that fit into Apple becoming a player here in this medical industry?
That raises the question, of course, about being your own physician. And
I don't think that's Apple's goal.
Well, yeah. That issue came up during the ECG discussion about how it's early warning and there are some caveats on it. But to get a really, really good ECG, you have to go into a doctor's office and have the multi-probe technique and get your multiple channels connected, wired up to get a, you know, really good reading. So to say that you can do your own medical diagnosis on your heart is far-fetched.
Yeah, absolutely.
On the other hand, there is a room for the personal computerization of the medical field and disintermediation, which is what Apple's kind of nibbling at too. First alerts, health maintenance. I had a discussion in the article about how maybe the monitoring of certain elements of your blood chemistry can lead to a more accurate timing of your medicine. You know, right now you have a bottle on the cabinet that says take, you know, once a day or twice a day. And when you take it's kind of up to your whim and fancy. But if your Apple Watch were to say something to you like, I've detected a certain blood chemistry level is low, you should take your medicine now rather than later. That's not being your own doctor. That's just aid and assistance and intelligent healthcare. So there's that.
Okay, but at that point, Apple is again working with, you know, Apple becomes this conduit between the existing medical industry and the patient slash customer. And that is still at odds with what Tim Cook was describing. I mean, clearly Apple Watch is an example of what he's talking about. But Apple Watch as, you know, it's becoming it's now what, the best-selling watch on the planet according to Apple.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of, I mean, you know that's kind of a, yeah, it, All right. Well, I don't want to go off on that particular tangent.
I see that as an early phase. I see that as a igniter of the industry.
It's not enough to make a dent in that $1 trillion. It's not. I don't care if everybody on the planet has. So I don't know. Actually, let's do some back of the napkin math. How many people are on the planet these days? 7 billion.
Seven, roughly.
7 billion. So let's see, 1, 2, 3. What is that? Is that million? Okay, there we go. 7 billion times, I don't know. Let's call it $300.
No, $300 is the entire yearly income of probably four.
I know billion. That's kind of my point. What's the average price? I'm sorry. So what's realistically speaking average price of a Apple Watch? What does it start up these days?
I know I should know. I think it's either $249 or $349, one or the other.
Yeah.
I think it's $349.
I think you're right. Of course, you can get the previous version. Why are you asking me to sign? I'm not a veteran. What are you doing? Why is it taking me to that?
Your online calculator is sending you a commercial?
No, I went to the Apple store and it's sending me to it's wanting me to accept the Veterans and Military Purchase Program, which I was investigating for a write up. But I'm not going there from a portal. Anyway, all right, so let's just call it $300, even though that's probably not right. So that'd be $200 billion. A year. Of course, not everybody would turn that over. It's just not enough to make a dent in the medical industry the way Tim Cook was hinting that Apple will. So when they talk about being a player in the medical industry, they are absolutely and positively not just talking about Apple Watch.
I know, but what I think about when you say that is Apple has to define its role very carefully, a role that allows them to succeed and grow and yet not cause alarm and friction within the industry. What I'm thinking of is Apple's attempt to get into the movie distribution industry the way they did with music, and the way Hollywood has held Apple at arm's length in terms of being a distributor of content and the way they spread the wealth out. Same with medical industry. There's so many players, so many financial interests and concerns, so many concerned and interested parties that Apple, in order to succeed, has to both understand its role and to be properly aggressive in technology so that we come to see them as a leader and trust them because of their privacy aspect.
Well, you just brought something out in my mind too, John. If Apple wants to be a player, wants to disrupt the medical industry in any way, even if it's a small corner of the industry, say, for instance, medical records. I'm still not sure how Apple would make money in the medical records business, but that is one of the areas where Tim Cook has specifically mentioned. Apple is going up against players in a heavily regulated market. And all of those other players are much more experienced at playing the regulatory game. It is not an insignificant challenge. It doesn't even matter if Apple is like way bigger than all these other companies and makes just tons of money. The other companies in the insurance business, in the medical device industry, they are all much more experienced at lobbying for regulations, navigating those regulations, dealing with regulations on a state by state basis as well as the federal basis, and that doesn't even count the rest of the world.
Yeah, what comes to mind is instances in the past when Apple got all out and had it ahead of everybody, and then couldn't make any more headway, and then kind of lost interest. I don't think Apple Pay is a good example, but it could have been. I mean, it started off that way, where Apple got out ahead of everybody, and then there was resistance and foot dragging. Apple has pulled the rabbit out of the hat, I think, with Apple Pay, in that they've maintained momentum and continued to engage customers and clients. But for a while there, it looked like the banks were going to say, okay, yeah, that was cool. That was a nice experiment with Apple Pay. Now we're going to take over this business of of NFC and contactless payments. But Apple's still in there fighting and doing a good job. They haven't given up. But well, Apple's given up in the past on things they couldn't have it their own way with.
They have often given up. You know, they started something and then it just becomes abandonware.
Yeah.
This has been the case again and again and again. And I think that was especially true under Steve, because when Steve would lose interest, there would be no resources in the company being directed at whatever he's lost interest in.
Well, I was at Apple when Steve was there, and his approach was, if you're really good at salesman, you'll convince the customer how cool this product is. And if they have their right mind on, their head screwed on straight, you'll educate them about how very cool this product is, and they'll abandon everything else. And sometimes enterprise and business people will go, no, we don't think so.
Well, yeah, no, we don't think so, in part, too, because of things like, you're not going to give us all the other things we want, too. We don't care. Right. We don't care how cool your thing is. You don't want to treat us like royalty. You don't want us to show us what's coming. You don't want to bring us into Apple and show us all the cool things.
And we're not fanboys. We have work to do.
Right. And we don't really have the power with your products. You know, if we bring your products into our company, we lose a lot of our power. That to me is a thing. But I didn't deal with enterprise, and I know that you were more in the science area, but did you ever run into that sort of attitude?
Oh, sure.
Absolutely. Like the whole thing about, you know, if we bring your products in, we lose our personal fiefdom because we're not as important to the company anymore. That's what I'm asking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was at an organization where my former Apple resource coordinator wrote a book for the director, and it was a three-ring binder with many, many pages of, this was 20 years ago, about why the organization should go Mac and Mac only and Mac heavy, and it just didn't cut it. But he kind of made himself persona non grata, because he was such a fanboy and so close-minded and so not interested in the best interest of his organization, which was a Windows organization with a smattering of Macs for the technical people who wished to have them. And when I took over his position, I started looking at what the organization needed and started coordinating with everybody who had a stakeholder in mind. And there was a place for Macs, but there was no place for being rude and pushy about the situation.
Sure.
So,
but you're talking about a position at a company that's not Apple. Or are you talking about being at Apple?
No, I'm talking about where I worked in Oak Ridge.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. So what I mean though, is, did you ever, as a salesman, did you ever run into people who were leery of bringing Apple into their organization on an IT basis? Because they knew that their own personal power would diminish.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And you could almost see the boxes that they needed to check in terms of developing infrastructure and directory services and email services. And Microsoft had this long list of enterprise requirements and tools and mail and collaboration and messaging and Outlook and Word and productivity and back-end services and publishing and email servers. What's the name of that? I forget the name of their email server. It was a big thing. It did all, and it was hard to maintain, and it was a problem, but it checked every box the corporation needed. And it's hard to come in with really cool one-off solutions that don't really do that. Exchange server was the bane of our existence on the sales team.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure.
All right. Interesting trip down memory lane. It's funny how unrelevant almost all that is now, right? like this space has changed so dramatically.
Yeah, Apple came up against a brick wall, and so they came in the back door with the phone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. Okay, so another thing that happened today was introduction of a privacy bill.
Yeah. I took a look at that article at the Mac Observer, and I looked at the link to what it was intended to do, and it seems like the horse is out of the barn. I mean, yeah, it's a good idea to set up the GDPR, but between a GDPR equivalent, but between all the breaches that have already happened, it's almost too late.
All right, so
it is too late.
So first of all, who introduced this? Is this
a group of 15 senators?
Bipartisan?
I don't see the list. I don't have a list. I should have printed out a
list.
Yeah,
this is cool, John. This is the Apple Context Machine. We don't prep ahead of time. let's see. Senators who introduced privacy bill. Let's see if that does it. Nope. John Kerry, I'm guessing that is old. 15 senators. Here we go.
I got it. Hassan Bennett, Duckworth, Klobuchar is a Democrat. Murray Booker is a Democrat.
Look for a Republican.
Cortez Mastro, a Democrat. Heinrich Markey is a Democrat. Brown, Baldwin Jones, Manchin, he's a Democrat from West Virginia. Mr. Durbin, it looks like mostly Democrats to me.
Yeah, probably go nowhere. Whatsoever in this particular Senate. I was hoping it was going to be bipartisan.
What really needs to be done, in my view, is some sort of bill that makes arrangements for punishment. But in this atmosphere of favor to businesses and businesses, you know, working with government almost to the exclusion of government service to the people, it's unlikely that there would be a bill that would introduce severe punishments for these kind of leaks. But, you know, the only way to stop companies from allowing internet hacks is to make the cost of the hack greatly more than the investment needed to secure their servers.
Yeah, I agree. You can't regulate hacks out of existence. To your point, you can only make them too expensive.
Yeah,
you can't.
That's right.
So, and it has to be too expensive in a way that actually makes sense, and that's the tricky part too. I mean, for instance, you could say that if your company experiences a data breach, you have to pay $1 trillion, and yeah, that's too expensive, but it's meaningless.
It has to be painful, but not unreasonable.
Right. Right, exactly.
I mentioned this before on TDO, that we license bridge engineers, we license doctors, we license other professionals. Restaurants, health department can take away your health permit if you make people sick. There's so many organizations and industries where you're responsible for the health of people. If a doctor screws up and kills too many people, he's licensed to practice medicine is pulled. And yet we allow companies to collect petabytes of information about all sorts of people. And when they breach it, there is no price to be paid, except they have to take the time to write a sorry note. Sorry, we lost all your data to the foreign government.
But so, you know, in the U.S., we tend to worship at the altar of the free market, at least on paper and at least in our minds. And I think that's one of the that greatly affects the thing that you just identified.
I'd like to see a situation where the first occurrence of a data breach, there's a significant and painful fine, and on the second breach, the license to operate is rescinded. You can no longer collect data on the internet from anybody.
Okay, but I mean, do we really want do we really want internet service providers to have to be licensed? Is that really a good idea?
Well, not necessarily internet service providers, but
or any companies. Any company.
Do we
do you want the government to be able to decide who can be in business and who cannot be in business?
Well, that's another side of the coin.
Well, that's what licensing means.
Well, that's like saying, do we really want the local government to decide which restaurant can be in business and which is not going to be in business? Clearly, there has to be a structure to the law such that if a company is operating normally, they can't be a victim of political retribution. But you don't see that happening with restaurants. Health department shuts them down if they're making people sick. Otherwise, we let them do their business.
Can I take you on a tangent?
Sure.
So, before TMO, I had a web development business, and before I had my web development business, this would have been obviously in the mid-90s. I was in the restaurant business, and I managed Domino's Pizza for a long time. One of my stores was in an old house that had been converted into a dry cleaner, you know, some decades before. And then from a dry cleaner became a Domino's. And it was an old building. It was not in great shape. And I guess this is actually before I started managing. So I was the MIT manager in training. And my manager and I wanted to get Domino's Pizza Incorporated to build us a new building, something that wasn't embarrassing and you know, falling apart. So we had a health inspector coming in. This was in Austin, Texas, by the way. This was the store that was on the University of Texas campus. And we had a health inspector coming in. So we took the health inspector and pointed her to all of the problems. Right, we pointed her like here's a hole in the floor. Right, here is where you know the walk-in leaks.
And I think I see where this is going.
No, you don't. That's the sad thing. We took her to all of the places. I mean, like any one of them should have gotten that store shut down, and she
and you passed, right?
We did not pass, but she would not shut us down. She would not shut us down. She said that she couldn't. But you know, it is very. I mean, like the hole in the floor in particular should have been a shutdown. I mean, that's you know, pests can get in through a hole in the floor. It's, I mean, that's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous. And there were plenty of other things that should have got a shutdown too. And you know, it's like. Even with a local regulatory framework, there's still a lot of personal, decision making on the part of the inspectors. Yeah. Anyway, so that's just
the price to pay for these breaches is too high.
It's not too high.
It should have been.
It's not too high, John. And here's another thing. Well, that was your point.
Is that what I'm saying? Maybe you misunderstood. What I'm saying is that the risk to American security and to American citizens is so high.
Oh, yes.
And we have these breaches like Marriott and Equifax that it's a national emergency and it has to be treated accordingly.
Well,
and
okay.
It's not being treated that way.
But one reason you mentioned something earlier about, you know, the companies not having to pay a price. And that's because we, the consumers, don't punish these companies. Like when Target had its big data breach, you know, consumers did not stop shopping at Target. And that, you know, just for an example. And you know, companies like we just tend to take this as oh well.
Yeah, well, that was predicted by science fiction writers 20 or 30 years ago that technology would accelerate to the point where regular human beings weren't able to deal with it and comprehend it. In the hands of a few hundred thousand technical specialists at Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Facebook, in the hands of 10 or 20,000 very specialized technical people, they've accelerated the technology of our internet life to the point where the mere you know, Tom and Mary in Des Moines, Iowa can no longer keep up. And so you get into a psychic freeze where you say, I can't deal with it. How do you deal with the data breaches? So there's nothing you can do. Once the data's out, there's nothing they can do except send you a we're sorry letter.
We could all stop shopping at the companies that have the data breaches. And that would turn
statistics.
It
in, that's like all the air molecules in the room suddenly going into one corner suffocating.
No, I know that it doesn't happen, and I know why it doesn't happen. And part of my point is that this reliance on the free market to take care of this would require that price to be paid in the form of consumers punishing companies who let this happen. That doesn't happen, and that's why we need some kind of regulatory framework to make this stuff too expensive, to your original point.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you can't regulate just how data is stored or anything like that. I mean, the government tends to be too slow at providing those kinds of solutions. But what government excels at is providing a system of standards and a way to judge against those standards, and then a cost against those standards. Like for instance, one of the things that I found interesting, and I think that the EU does a better job of this than the United States, is that a company will be fined, a modern tech giant will be fined for breaking a rule, and they'll be fined a massive $15 million. You know, $15 million doesn't mean anything to Google or Facebook or Apple. Not that Apple's been fined that way, but I think Google has been fined that way. And that turns a lot of regulated problems into a cost of doing business rather than an impediment to keep those things from happening in the first place.
Well,
did that lose you?
No, I'm still here. I'm pondering what you said. It's tricky business to figure out how to find a company so that it's painful, but it doesn't.
It's a really tricky business.
Slow down their profits.
Well, it needs to slow down their profits. Yeah. There needs to be a price to pay for these data breaches, and for sure there needs to be a price to pay. And the free market is not charging that price.
Yeah, but what happens is they send lobbyists to Washington and spend a lot of money on getting their favored congressmen and senators reelected, and that's been a problem with American government for a while.
Yep, agreed. Yeah, good times, right? And again, yeah. So and this kind of takes us back to the previous discussion where Apple wants to be a player where it's going up against smaller companies, but those companies are long versed in working the regulatory side of things.
I wonder if Apple could start a subsidiary where they train other companies how to be as secure as Apple is. Mm-hmm. IBM, that's the kind of an IBM kind of thing. IBM sells its expertise that way.
Huh. That's an interesting idea. That's an interesting idea, John. I mean, I wouldn't want to see Apple Incorporated, the product company, get bogged down by something like that.
Right, and Apple tends not to develop subsidiaries because it requires an independent vice president. But in this case, it's so orthogonal to what Apple does, I think there wouldn't be any problem.
Yeah, and then if they formed an independent company to do this, would they let that independent company have access to what they're doing so the independent company could share
probably
it in the
not.
First place?
Yeah, well, wouldn't have access to product information, but they might have access to technology information so that they could.
But it's all integrated into the whole.
They're into services, right? This is just one more of their services.
That's an interesting idea. And of course, then if they were also teaching this stuff, the way Apple does things would also be more out in the wild, which makes Apple potentially more vulnerable because more people would know how they're doing stuff.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But a rising surface floats many more boats. So
rising surface, you're such a nerd. All right. Speaking of nerds, AI is something you and I both think about a lot. And my question, like, I know that on Tuesday, might not be yesterday to everyone listening at this particular moment, but on Tuesday, you pointed us to a piece predicting what was going to be happening with AI in 2019.
Yeah, Forbes collected a breakdown of what AI experts were predicting for 2019. Not that we have to limit the discussion to 2019, but you know, this stuff is moving on an exponential curve, and it's you got to start looking at the impact of what's happening quickly to prepare for fast changing events. One of the things that was discussed was the potential open source of AI code in order to allow more people to become involved and to make the code develop faster. Of course, open sourcing AI code makes it available to bad actors as well. To quote from the article, others are predicting to arm and prepare against advanced cyber attacks. AI-driven cyber attacks are described as curiously as crimeware as a service. When you start putting AI technology in the hands of bad actors, it'll make phishing schemes look like nothing much at all, and we can deal with those. But when you're trying to figure out who you're dealing with on the internet, what website you're dealing with, who's calling you on the phone, who you're talking to on Skype, what avatar you're interested in, how your avatar is talking to somebody else's avatar in the style of Google's demo of Duplex, where you have an agent for yourself talking to another agent, and then you have to monitor the integrity and the security of that connection at a distance and hope that your avatar is smart enough and clever enough to deal with the shenanigans of their avatar.
You know what that reminds me of, by the way?
What?
I've got a D-Bot Osmo 930. That's the vacuum, smart vacuum, robot vacuum from Ecovacs.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You had the fellow from Ecovacs on.
Yeah, Mr. Kane. Yeah, he was cool.
Yeah, smart guy. Anyway, I got one of those devices, and it is a very good robot vacuum, but it has trouble dealing with the lip of the on the floor from going from the hallway and then my office into the kitchen. There's a lip, and I have a point for all this. And the robot has trouble negotiating that height difference. And so what I end up needing to do is standing there watching my robot vacuum doing its thing and helping it if it crosses that lip, because I got to help it get back up.
Sort of like a puppy dog. You got to give it a little push.
Well, yeah, but the point is that I've got this thing. I've got this robot vacuum so that I don't have to spend time vacuuming. And then what am I doing? I'm standing there monitoring it. So, like, you know, are we going to be sitting there listening to our agents as they negotiate for us? Because, you know, that's
right.
But we probably should. We probably should be monitoring what they're doing.
Well, we're in the early adopter phase for a lot of these technologies, where companies are, you know, just taking their first cut at something that 20 years from now is going to be really in its stride. But we early adopters are sort of like the beta testers for the companies, you know, developing their new technologies. So I expect those kinds of problems to go away. But back to the subject of, you know, dealing with breaches, how are the average Americans going to deal with very sophisticated AI assaults when they can't really now deal with, you know, simple phishing attacks?
Yeah, that is an excellent point, especially when semi-hostile foreign governments are involved in these attacks, like mm-hmm. we saw with the Chinese being involved, the Chinese government being involved with this attack on a Marriott system.
Right.
And, you know, like, a gang of would-be criminal Russians, or, you know, or anyway, any sort of criminal gang, it'll be a while before they have access to AIs to help them do these, like, phishing assaults and other kinds of attacks against this. But A, that'll come, and B, before that comes, the Russians can do it, the U.S. could do it to other people, and the Chinese can do it. And I mean, the point is that the governments do have access to AIs,
and we're not well protected. We expose our servers to the internet directly. We don't have boxes to sit between us and the internet. There's deep packet and state inspection routers that look for problems with incoming traffic, but it's pretty mechanized and it's pretty simple. You know, I'd like to see an AI agent sitting on my network, monitoring everything and talking to me continuously. Hey, John, I just saw this interesting denial of service attack coming from Dallas, Texas. You know, I blocked it, just so you know. Here's the IP address if you want to report it. I've written it to a log. Yeah. Have a nice day.
Come on, John. To be fair, you ran a little snitch. I mean, who's got time?
Well, that's why we need Smart Siri to talk to us more at a deeper, more sophisticated conversational level to help us out. We're going to, by and by, every individual is going to need more sophisticated assistance. And it's one thing to ask Siri, you know, where there's a good Mexican restaurant for tonight's dinner. But that's not the biggest problem that Siri's going to face in the future.
Hopefully that's not the big, because I do trust Apple with this stuff.
Yeah, and the question is, how much visibility, how many hints do we have that Apple's working on these kinds of systems? We don't even have any hints that Apple's working on family robots. And we don't have many hints about what Apple's doing to protect us from bad actor AIs in the future, too, either. Right now, the focus is on internal security, you know, secure enclave in your phone, encryption, and so on. But it's going to get a lot more tricky, faster.
It's going to get hairy out there.
Yeah.
And one of the things you didn't mention is the, but you mentioned it in our meeting this morning, is the aspect of all this AI research being open sourced, which gives.
Yeah, I did mention that a few minutes ago.
Did you? Where was I?
Yeah, I did.
where was I? Sorry about that. So,
yeah,
all right.
What could go wrong there?
Huh? Yeah, then what can go wrong there? And let me just. All right, so that means I edited that out. No one's going to know what a doofus I am. that's how we roll here on ACM. All right, John, I want to very much thank you for being my guest this week. I'm very, 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 very much looking forward to the next time you're on the show. So we should have done this a long time ago, huh?
Well, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed chatting with you. We had a wide-ranging discussion that was a lot of fun.
Good. I am very glad to hear that. And this is what we do to take us out. Oops. First, we rewind. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. I want to thank John Martellaro for co-hosting with me this week. It was very lovely. If you have anything to add, comment on, question, write us over at acm@macobserver.com. Join us over at facebook.com/groups/context machine. And our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly, the basses by Boom, recorded just for TMO. That's all for this week. And once again, John, thanks.
You're welcome.
I do appreciate it.